From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
We visit a rural school district and find that the biggest issues there aren't so much different from education debates in the state's biggest cities.
I think that if the parents were more proactive instead of reactive, it would help.
Also this week, if you choose to take a state voucher to send your child to private school, choosing the school itself might be more difficult than it seems at first.
But with a private school, it takes a lot more piecing together of information to understand sort of the context of a school.
We'll also check out a grassroots community group that helps families that have been fractured by ice and see how changing climate is impacting the state's shorebird population. I'm Tom Flanagan. On air and online, this is Capitol Report and our end-of-the-week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. The August 18th Florida primary election is less than a month away. That means lots of news about the big statewide and major metropolitan races. But sometimes there's just as much excitement and drama in the more rural parts of the state. Residents throughout the panhandle will be asked to vote for school board members this August. In Jackson County, the Rural News Service's Randy Buxta introduces us to the two candidates running for a seat in District 1.
The Jackson County School Board will have two seats up for election August 18th. In District 1, there are two candidates, current school board member Cephas Granberry, who is looking for re-election, and Christopher King. Granberry was born, raised, and educated in Jackson. He's worked as a school bus driver, paraprofessional, data entry specialist, administrative assistant, and transportation manager. This, says Granberry, is what he brings to the table.
I bring a different outlook as far as making sure that all employees as well as students are taken care of. I am a student of Jackson County. I went through the school district, so I have a experience on both sides of the dais.
Currently, Granberry is a funeral director in Jackson and has been on the school board for the past 3.5 years. Granberry says that one of his main focuses is getting the parents more involved with the schools.
I think parents need to be invited and encouraged to come to the school to participate in activities and not just wait until the kids get in school and get in trouble in school and then you have to go out there. So I think that if the parents were more proactive instead of reactive, it would help.
Granberry also highlighted the importance of the libraries to students to help with statewide reading levels.
When I was coming in school, you know, going to the library was a part of our schedule, and we, you know, we're not making the library a place where, you know, it will attract our students like it should. So I think we need to work on the way we present the concept of the library.
Granberry is pro public school, and he will be facing off against Christopher King. King has lived in Jackson County for 51 years, is married with two kids who both attend Graceville Public School, and King's background is in budget and finance. He's the current vice president of business administration at Baptist University of Florida, a private Christian college.
I understand higher education, the complexities that it possesses, the compliance issues that you must fall within, that being both on a federal level and on a state level.
King says one of the biggest issues the district faces is finding high-value teachers and keeping them in the area.
We've got to do a better job, hopefully, of retaining our workforce, our students, providing a place for them where they'll want to stay once they graduate. We've got to provide opportunities, and the opportunities, in my opinion, come through them being educated. You know, we've got to be able to create a workforce that employers would want to come here and take advantage of that workforce.
King is not a supporter of school vouchers. Instead, he wants to shore up support for Jackson's public schools while keeping an eye on the district's finances.
We want to make sure the schools are strong to feel the need so that parents don't feel like they need to use vouchers. That's kind of my stance. I would like to make sure our schools, we need to do a better job of marketing that we have really good schools, we have high quality teachers, and that these resources are there for them to use for their students.
Both candidates say technology in the classroom is important.
They need to associate with people more so.
That's Granberry.
More so than with devices.
Here's King.
I think a lot of children need to have it in their hand, not always on the tablet. I think you can't teach children to read without high-quality, complex text.
And while school board races in the state are nonpartisan, Granberry is a registered Democrat and King is a registered Republican. Voting for school board officials in Jackson County will occur August 18th, with early voting beginning August 6th. In Jackson County for the Rural News Service, I'm Randy Vuxta.
A recent investigation from the nonprofit newsroom ProPublica revealed some private schools in Florida are receiving state funding despite previous illicit activities of its leaders. ProPublica journalist Molly Simon discusses tips for researching private schools with WGCU Southwest Florida In Focus host Jennifer Crawford.
Can you explain the voucher system and how parents are using these vouchers to offset the costs of their children attending private schools?
Yeah, it really varies across the country what exactly these look like. So the the specific nature of the program, it depends on the state that you're in. But in general, in the last few years, we've seen, really explosive growth in the number of states that are providing forms of public dollars for individuals to attend private schools, and sometimes that's through tax credits that go to sort of intermediary organizations that help then provide funding for tuition. Sometimes it's directly through vouchers that go to families. Sometimes it's through education savings accounts. So it depends on where you're at, what that looks like exactly, and what amount of things like tuition are covered.
So one situation in Florida was a woman charged with sexual abuse of a minor. And she opened a school, and it seems she was only found out because someone posted her mugshot on Facebook. Have you seen issues with the state's handling of private schools that allows people like this to take advantage of the school voucher program?
Yeah, I think, stepping back, one of the issues that we've seen is that in that case in Florida, they did, rescind her ability to participate in the Step Up for Students program. But it came after the fact, after she had already, established the school under using, someone else's documents, as has been reported in Florida. So it took the community stepping in to be paying attention to who was creating the school for that to come to light. So I think even in some states where we do see some regulatory checkboxes, it's when do they come into play? And are they happening before individuals decide, where they want to send their kids? And it's not that check is happening always on the front end. And it took, the community bringing that case to light for it to come to the attention of the state, as we understand the timeline.
Well, you also had an article on how parents can do their own research, how important that is to ensure that the institution they are choosing to send their children to is legit. What tips do you have for parents out there who are looking into this, into private school vouchers?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing to think about is there are documents out there that can provide information about schools. It's not, unfortunately, as straightforward as when you're thinking about a public school. And it's important to do, backgrounding work and to think about where you're sending your child to a public school as well, of course. But with a private school, it takes a lot more piecing together of information to understand sort of the context of a school. So I think some of the general tips, think about who is in the classroom with your student. Think about what documents you might be able to find about them, but also, take the time to, at the most basic level, do some Googling and see, when you search someone's name, and doing that in conjunction with whatever pieces of information you have about them, their name, the fact that they're an educator, the location that you're in, and see what comes up. And I think in the case of the woman that we were, speaking about, who I should note did not respond to requests for comment from ProPublica, in that scenario, looked at her school and had you Googled her name, you would have found that past history of what she had previously lost her educator's license over. So I think doing some basic searching of names is a really important first step. Something else that I'd suggest is, you know, financial stability is really important when it comes to private schools and making sure that they will last through the school year. So another suggestion that we've made for folks is a lot of private schools do operate as nonprofits. ProPublica maintains something called the Nonprofit Explorer, where we gather 990 filings, which are something that nonprofits, depending on their size and depending on how much money they deal with, file with the IRS each year. And so we have a database of those as they're published, and that's a great place to look and see if your school is on there. You know, is the school bringing in at a basic level more money than it's spending, and sort of that basic, like, is it staying afloat over a number of years? So, you know, there's more tips. We'd love for you to, you know, look at the full list that we have online, but I think that's some basic starting places is think about who's in the classroom. Also check for educator certificates where you are. Those can be an important indicator, as they were in our reporting in Florida, to see what someone's history may include, if they've had any discipline as an educator in the public system. But then also, you know, seeing what other financial documents you may be able to find about a school to make sure that, you know, it's operating in a way that will allow it to stay afloat.
That's ProPublica journalist Molly Simon with WGCU Southwest Florida In Focus host Jennifer Crawford. Coming up on Capitol Report, a Florida school board that's being sued for banning books is deposing students, but not board members.
Our case challenges a series of decisions by the Escambia County School Board to remove hundreds of books from school libraries.
A Florida community group is helping families when ICE comes calling.
Sheriff stopped us, and when they took her dad away, and she cried, and she has suffered some trauma about it.
If Florida were a separate country, it would have the world's 14th largest economy.
And we're attracting a lot of wealth to Florida. We're attracting a lot of companies.
And a trip to the beach right now doesn't involve only sand and shells. It's shorebird nesting season, and the news isn't all good. Well, before we leave the topic of education, a Florida school board sued for banning books has deposed some of its own students who were plaintiffs. One was a 7-year-old who wanted access to a picture book. Yet, WUSF's Douglas Soule reports, the board members are trying to avoid being deposed themselves.
The case has made it all the way up to a federal appeals court, where judges heard arguments this week. One judge said it was a, quote, very difficult case. A deposition is an interview conducted under oath, with lawyers asking questions. School board members argue they shouldn't have to. They say their book banning decisions are covered by legislative privilege. Here's how Jeffrey Groschholtz, an attorney for the Escambia County Board, puts it.
Because we believe that this is a core policy matter regarding educational suitability, we believe that the legislative privilege protects these decisions.
Ori Lev is an attorney for the plaintiffs, who include students and their parents, as well as authors, a major book publisher, and the free speech group PEN America.
Our case challenges a series of decisions by the Escambia County School Board to remove hundreds of books from school libraries, disproportionately books by or about people of color or LGBTQ people. We want to be able to ask the school board members why.
Lev tells WUSF the actions aren't covered by legislative privilege, saying the board was applying existing policy to individual books, not performing a legislative function. A federal judge previously agreed with this, which is why the board appealed. Lev calls all this a, quote, sideshow from the main issue of book bans, but it's one with big precedent-setting stakes. I'm Douglas Soule in Tallahassee.
The Department of Homeland Security says it has detained almost 900,000 people since January of 2025. Immigrant rights advocates say this has caused families to be separated. But in Bonita Springs, a grassroots goodwill response is helping separated families who are suffering. Culture and Connections reporter Elizabeth Andarji introduces us to the Adopt an ICE Widow Family Initiative and to the Florida Immigration Coalition. Both are advocating for fair treatment of immigrants.
The adoption started informally. Today, 15 families are a part of the program. Adopters commit to monthly support, a minimum of $100 a month. One of those families belongs to Rosa. Her adopter, Joan Burton, has been visiting her for months now.
It was such a beautiful family going through such a very tough time, and that I had no idea how tough it really was.
Rosa chose to wear a traditional piece from her home country of Guatemala alongside her 7-year-old daughter, Genesis, that she now raises alone, and was there when her husband was detained.
Fortunately, my little one witnessed the whole thing. We were at the car when the sheriff stopped us and when they took her dad away. And she cried, and she has suffered some trauma about it, and that has stayed with her.
Rosa says her husband came to the United States in 2000. He was detained on January 6th of this year. Now she's raising Genesis alone.
What sacrifices have you had to make to keep your family going during this transition?
It has been very hard because my husband was the main breadwinner. I did work, but I just contributed a little bit to the family. But now it's all on me. And I just work a limited number of hours a week.
Burton says watching Rosa hold her family together is what keeps her coming back.
This mother is creative about surviving in this environment, and that's what they do. They survive in a difficult environment, in a horrible situation that we as a country have put them in.
Yeah, they have taken a lot of people away, including women with babies. The kids have remained without a mother. I just want to remind people that most of us come here to work, not to commit crimes.
See you next week. Okay. I'm Elizabeth Andarji.
Florida's economy and population has boomed in recent years. The Florida Chamber recently announced the state has the 14th largest economy globally and the second fastest growing in the U.S., but that growth has contributed to rising housing and other costs in the state. Tristan Wood reports that's impacting where people in the state are deciding to live.
Florida has spent years attracting new residents and businesses. Mark Wilson is president and CEO of the Florida Chamber of Commerce. He says Florida's economy has reached a scale few states and entire countries can match.
We have about a $1.8 trillion economy in Florida. That's bigger than Saudi Arabia. We just passed Mexico, so that's a pretty good thing for people in Florida to see as a comparison. So it happened by design. We're making the right decisions. And we're attracting a lot of wealth to Florida. We're attracting a lot of companies.
Florida is part of a broader population shift toward the American South that accelerated during the COVID-19 pandemic. The South is the fastest growing region in America over the past 5 years, and the only one that has expanded across all age groups. Wilson says that growth has sparked competition with other states in the region to attract workers, families, and companies.
Florida's not the only state that's the winner here. We're competing with Texas, Georgia, South Carolina, Tennessee. So as capital and businesses and families leave these high-cost, high-regulation states and come to states like Florida, we have to make sure that Florida has the best quality of life, the best health care, sort of that best mix of why you would want to live here and why you would want to learn here and why you would want to have your business here.
But the latest population trends suggest a part of Florida's explosion, its population growth, is slowing. 600,000 people moved to Florida in 2022, but that number was down to 200,000 last year.
That's according to an analysis of census estimates from the University of Florida's Scheinberg Center for Housing Studies. Anne Ray, a researcher at the Scheinberg Center, says the population in some high-cost-of-living counties, like Miami-Dade County, have seen population drops.
So the highest-cost counties are starting to lose population and migration. In other places, it's simply slower. In our fastest-growing counties, so places like Polk, Pasco County, and a lot of parts of the Panhandle, actually, we're continuing to see population growth and in-migration.
She says part of this migration out is due to people in mid to lower income jobs in those locations not being able to keep up with rising housing costs. She pointed out that many of Florida's fastest growing communities are places where housing is still relatively affordable, but still within commuting distance from the state's larger metros, with wide job offerings. Those counties have also seen some of the most single-family home and other new property construction in the state.
It's a bit of a chicken and egg question, right? Are people moving to these places because there's more housing being built, or is there more housing being built because more people are moving there? But we definitely see a lot of growth in the counties in Florida where housing costs are more modest.
And one group that has been hit harder with rising housing costs are younger Floridians. At the same time Florida was seeing significant population growth in 2023, more people aged 20 to 29 left the state than moved in. Wilson says the Florida Chamber recognizes those trends. He thinks making housing more affordable for young people and further collaboration with the state's universities is what is needed to continue to drive Florida's economy into the future.
We have over 500,000 open jobs in Florida right now. Many of them are high-paying, high-skill jobs in Florida. We need to make sure we're training younger talent for the types of jobs that Florida is going to have in the future, because even though our economy is based on tourism, agriculture, construction, we're increasingly moving to high-tech, high-skill, life sciences, advanced, you know, manufacturing, engineering, defense, etc. And so the mix of kind of talent that we need, especially with our younger workforce, is changing.
I'm Tristan Wood.
You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, spending time along our beaches becomes even more enjoyable now as shorebird nesting season begins. Southwest Florida In Focus host Jennifer Crawford speaks with Audubon Florida's Megan Hatton.
We are about to wrap up their breeding season. So for shorebirds, they breed from about March to the end of August. So we're having a lot of chicks that are about to fledge, which means they can fly finally. So they're learning how to forage and all things on their own. And we're moving into migration. So we're already starting to see a few early comers showing up on our beaches from our northern states. And then we also have some birds that nest here, like our least terns, that are going to start moving out of the area and down into like the Caribbean and South America. So a lot of movement coming in and out of Florida right now.
What kinds of shorebirds would we expect to see if we head out to our waterways right now?
Right now, you're going to see a lot of our nesting species. So we'll have black skimmers, we'll have our least terns, Wilson plovers, snowy plovers. And American oyster catchers are our main five nesting species for our area. I have been starting to see a lot of willets coming back into our area, short-billed dowitchers. These are all migratory shorebirds that are finishing up nesting up north, and they're starting to make their way down here. So it's an exciting time to be out there because you'll start to see some of our more interesting shorebirds returning to the area.
They're so beautiful, aren't they?
Yeah.
Now, we have heard this really remarkable news that it's been more than 30 years, but now black skimmers on Sanibel are having baby chicks.
Yeah.
What has caused this to occur now after so long?
So, obviously, after Ian, the causeway was severely damaged, and there was a lot of rebuilding happen on there. Part of the rebuild was laying down new gravel for all the parking areas. Gravel looks a lot like our sand. So we already had least terns in the area nesting. The black skimmers are a new addition to this year. I know SCCF, which is the Sanibel Conservation Group, monitors that area. And so they were really excited when the black skimmers came. And now they're very excited that we're having chicks starting to hatch on there. And like you said, it's been 30 years. And just that one little change of environment adding in that new gravel open area really invited them in.
What are the biggest disturbances to the habitats of our shorebirds?
So humans is one of our big ones. When they're out on the beaches, our birds are, when they're in breeding, they're trying to protect their nests. They have to stay, their eggs are right on the sand. And if you're out in the summer, out on the beach, you know how hot the sand is. So they have to be able to stay on their eggs to keep them safe. If there's people walking too close or even a dog walking too close, those birds get scared off and they're not sitting on their eggs then, leaving those eggs vulnerable to the heat and also to predators. So there's a lot of threats. And you're also thinking about sea level rise is also causing habitat to change. So areas that used to be safe now may be flooding because that water is coming up higher than it has before, making that site no longer a viable site for them.
And you are one that helps track all of these movements through this migratory bird initiative. What is this initiative and why is it important?
So the initiative is to gather as many different partners we can from all the way from international and federal level down to local chapters and volunteers to fill knowledge gaps of the annual cycle of migratory birds. Because we know a lot about a lot of their breeding sites are known. We have pretty good understandings of where these breeding sites are. Wintering sites for most species we do know. Kind of that in-between point, we don't exactly know where they're stopping, what areas are. So by filling in those knowledge gaps of their entire annual cycle helps Audubon focus their conservation efforts on areas that has the greatest threat to those birds. So if we're seeing that certain species are all dying off in this area, if we could kind of address why is that happening there, or if we want to like try to protect certain lands and things like that from getting developed. Well, the initiative identifies those areas that are most needed for protection by learning more about different species' full migration routes. So they're using multiple different types of tracking down from, I do very like population count surveys, but there's people out there doing radio telemetry through the MODIS network. So they'll capture birds, band them, you might see some birds with leg bands on them. So that's one way that we can track them. And then they also get these little backpacks that are little radio signals. And as they're flying, there's these towers through the MODIS network that will ping, and they'll ping that bird off that tower. And then that's a data point. Okay, this bird was here on this date, and then it was at the next point on this date. So we can kind of see how quickly they're moving and what areas they're using the most. So different kind of tracking based on different birds are helping us fill in those knowledge gaps. And then we use that to collaborate with partners on all sorts of levels.
That's Megan Hatton of Audubon, Florida, with WGCU's Jennifer Crawford. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents, Sergina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, Randy Buxta, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Jennifer Crawford, Douglas Soule, and Elizabeth Ndarji. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Join us again next week, on air and online, for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.